Our next speaker is a journalist, Annalene Nuitz, who covers the cultural impact of science and technology. She is the editor of io9.com, which is a science blog, also a science fiction blog. Lots of interesting artwork on there as well. She was the co-editor of the essay collection She's Such a Geek. She's come a very long way from sunny California to be with us today. Please give her a big welcome.
Thanks very much for having me. I have to sort of get into position here. As I said in the introduction, I spend a lot of time thinking about both science and science fiction in my writing and in my work. When I think about technology innovation and when I think about scientific innovation, I often think about it sort of overlapping with science fiction stories, and I tend to think sort of at the nexus of those two areas. So what I'm hoping to do today with you is talk a little bit about how science fiction doesn't so much cause innovation, but how it becomes a kind of environment in which we innovate, and why that matters, and why it's interesting to pay attention to science fiction as innovators and as developers, and how that most especially will shape the way your audiences and communities are going to receive new technologies and new ideas that you're producing, because science fiction forms a kind of cultural test bed, in a sense. So I see science fiction as being in a kind of feedback loop, as Nat would have said yesterday in his talk, with both the sort of laboratory where you're innovating or the sort of developer's room where you're innovating, and being in a relation from there with science. And what I mean by that is that science fiction is sort of a public arena where we talk about the way science and technology will impact our lives, both good and bad. It can either be sort of this apocalyptic scenario where robots are going to destroy us all, or a happy scenario where robots are going to save us all, depending on which film you're watching or which book you're reading. And a lot of those ideas wind up sort of inspiring people in the laboratory, or they wind up just sort of forming a deep background for what people are doing when they're innovating everything from, say, the internet to new weapon systems. We all know that oftentimes when people are innovating with technology that they actually use the terms from science fiction. So when these ideas go into the laboratory, they sort of leave the public sphere. So you have science fiction, which is a very public discussion about how science and technology affect us. And then those ideas kind of go into the lab, and people spend time under NDA, and they don't talk about what they're doing, or they don't talk about it because they're embarrassed because they think they'll fail. Regardless, that's not a public area. So that's an area where innovation is taking place where mostly the public is not aware of it. And even if the public were aware, they might be somewhat confused by the sort of specialist terms that are being used there. And then once ideas hit, once the rubber sort of meets the road with business and products coming to market, you see those ideas coming back out into the public sphere again. So that's why I think that this feedback loop I have up here is interesting to think about, because what you're seeing are ideas going from a public space of imagination into a kind of private space of innovation, and then back out into a public space of commerce. And so business and science fiction are the areas where you have to care most about what either consumers or users or audiences are going to think about that technology, either because you want them to buy it, well, mostly I think because you want them to buy it, but also because you want them to use it in a way that you intended, or in a way that's socially productive, and that they're not turning into sort of griefers or misusing it in some way that I can't even imagine. So one of the ways I talk about this is that science fiction is a kind of cultural baggage. I had a really interesting conversation with the synthetic biologist Drew Endy, who's done a lot of work around trying to create a public library of biological parts, sort of at the genetic level, which is called BioBricks. And he does a lot of public speaking, and he deals a lot with trying to teach people about what it means to build new life forms. And he says, he told me he hates science fiction because so many stories in science fiction have predisposed people to hate what he's doing. They think that cloning is gross and evil. They think that if you're creating new life forms, you're probably creating a monster. We've all seen Species. I mean, that's what happens, right? If you go into the lab with a bunch of scientists, they build like a super hot chick who has like spines that come out of her back and like bites your genitals off. Well, actually, she doesn't bite genitals off, but pretty much. I mean, that's sort of the that's sort of the basic fear, or that you're going to come out with some other kind of monster. And so when he's doing his scientific work, which is perfectly reasonable and I promise will not result in any sort of alien life forms that bite your genitals off, he has to kind of cut through those stories and say, like, no, we're not doing the Frankenstein thing. We're not doing the species thing. We're not inventing a weird new life form that will kill everyone. It's not the Andromeda strain. And so I think that idea of cultural baggage is really important to thinking about that relationship between science and science fiction. But the other side of that is that it also, science fiction stories create an environment in which we can train or get users ready for how to use new devices. So for example, right now, most people who go to the movies are familiar with the idea of gestural interfaces. Anyone who saw the movie Minority Report, which was beautifully designed, maybe not the greatest movie on earth, actually the filmmakers who did Minority Report brought in scientists from MIT and asked them, like, what will computers look like in 20 years? Or 50 years or 100 years. So they were very self-conscious about that. And there's a lot of scenes in that film where we see Tom Cruise, who's like the mega cop, using computers, using gestures as instead of, you know, clicking on a mouse. So he's introducing audiences, or not him, but this film and many other films like it have already accustomed people to the idea that, you know, that they could use a computer by waving their hand, or that they could take a picture just by doing this with their fingers. Even though most people aren't working with gestural interfaces right now, that kind of film prepares people for the next generation of products. And like I said, it's maybe more or less self-conscious. I think in another case, for example, Star Trek with the tricorders, we all wanted tricorders. I mean, we still all want tricorders, right? The idea of the tricorder, which is the little machine that the people use on Star Trek that goes like boop, 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 and they say, Captain, this atmosphere has lots of acid in it. We shouldn't go down. Or they go, boop, this animal is made of part chickadee and part horse. So it's basically like a smartphone with like a mass spectrometer jammed inside of it. I think that kind of device, when we first saw it in sort of science fiction of the 1960s, or when people at that time saw it, kind of helped pave the way for smartphones. And so there was a long history of people understanding what a smartphone was and how it might function long before we were arguing over Android versus iPhone. So that's another example of sort of how that the sort of cultural baggage of science fiction can basically work for you. So I really quickly want to talk about a couple examples of how science fiction shaped our perception of the internet and gave us a vocabulary to talk about it. And then I'm going to move on and talk about some new science fiction and sort of what kind of stories it's telling people today, audiences and consumers, about how they might interact with future products or today's products. Most people are familiar with the term cyberspace, which was coined by the science fiction author William Gibson in his book Neuromancer in the early 80s. This phrase isn't the idea of cyberspace. I think a lot of people get confused when they think about the relation between science fiction and technology, and they say, well, the idea of the internet came out of Neuromancer, which is not only temporally incorrect, because of course the internet sort of existed long before his writing, but also it's not really the right way to think about how social fantasies like science fiction interact with real innovation. It's not so much that William Gibson invents the idea of cyberspace, which is just a phrase for what he calls a consensual hallucination, where you kind of jack into the internet, so you kind of get the internet like in your brain as opposed to like through a monitor, through the crappy monitor interface. And it's what you see when you go there. So you jack in, suddenly you're in this space, which is the internet, and it's a geographical space. It's filled with buildings and boulevards and avatars of people. So what he was doing wasn't predicting sort of what we would all invent, despite what Second Life claims. We're not there yet. We may never be there yet. Whatever we invent when we jack our brains into computers probably won't look like that. But what the phrase did, cyberspace, and the idea of it was give us a vocabulary for talking about the experience of being online. So it gave us a sense that the internet, and now the web, is a geographical space where we have addresses, and we go to places there. So instead of, say, using the metaphor of books, where we like, say, if we were to have considered the internet a book, where we would only talk about sort of pages, you know, I'm turning to a page as opposed to I'm going to an internet address, or I'm going to a URL. So basically, sort of now we live in the vocabulary that Gibson and other science fiction writers of his era invented for us to talk about how we navigate space on the web. And just the fact that we even talk about it as a space, or we talk about the blogosphere, which is another, which is sort of a terrible term that I hate, but it kind of has that same idea of being a space. It's a sphere. It's like a blob of atmosphere floating in space, and we all kind of zoom around in it. That's very important to how we understand the way that we use the internet. the other, everybody loves Tron. So the other really important early science fiction work, I would argue, for how we understand life in cyberspace is Tron, which was a film that came out in the early 80s. How many people have seen Tron? Okay, that's good. I was sort of polling people earlier, and I was shocked and appalled to discover that many people did not know Tron. Anyway, so the idea behind Tron is very similar to the notion of cyberspace, which is that when you go inside computers, which of course, because it's sort of a magical sci-fi story, the characters actually can't enter the space of video games and enter the space of giant mainframes. It's a geographical space. It has geographical features. They can walk around in it. But the other thing that was really interesting about Tron that I think we need to hold on to is the fact that the way the world was conceived was that every time a programmer writes a program, that program is a version of him or herself that exists in cyberspace. So Tron, who's one of the heroes, is actually played by the same actor who is the programmer who writes the program. Tron is a security program, and the great thing about Tron is that he fights for the users, okay? He fights against the evil master control program who wants to create a monolithic computing space. But Tron, he fights for the users. He fights for all those human people outside the screen whose little versions of themselves live inside the computer. The reason why I think it's important is that Tron popularized the idea of users, popularized the idea of a medium where you didn't just sit there and watch the screen, but there was a little version of you that like went inside and like rode light cycles around. And like when you played a video game, it wasn't just like you at the screen, it was like you inside, you're the user. Not only did it help popularize the idea of users, but it popularized the idea of a hero who fights for us. Tron fights for the users. It's very exciting. And so that kind of language, again, really shaped still the internet that we use today and the web that we use today, where we think of users as a constituency almost. And you know, we're still living in that vocabulary, the Tron vocabulary. A movie like The Matrix, I think, what's interesting about it is even though obviously the special effects are cooler, although Keanu Reeves like kind of isn't really as hot as the actors who were in Tron, but you know, there's still some you know similarities. They're quite different in a lot of ways, but there's almost the same vocabulary is being used in The Matrix to talk about the experience of being in cyberspace, which in The Matrix they call The Matrix. It's the same idea that you have a version of yourself in the real world and a little version of yourself in The Matrix, and that there's a connection and that someone needs to fight for you and represent you somehow. And of course, in The Matrix, there's a whole sort of complicated political backstory to that. But the sort of overarching point I wanted to make is that we're still now living in that vocabulary that was invented in the early 80s. The web is existing in a kind of science fictional vocabulary that hasn't really changed all that much, despite the special effects getting better. So now let's go into the present day and think a little bit about some contemporary examples of how science fiction is providing us with a vocabulary for talking about new technologies and emerging technologies. This is also my chance to talk about Android, which totally rules and is way better than the iPhone. that was just a small amount of editorializing. So when Android was being developed first outside Google and then within Google for the G phone or G1 or whatever term we're going to eventually use, it was during the same time that a new version of the TV show Battlestar Galactica was on the air. Woohoo! How many people are, here's a question, how many people are Battlestar Galactica fans? And how many people hate Battlestar and they're sick of hearing about it? Okay. So I think what that indicates, there's a pretty significant minority who are like, shut the hell up, right? But I think that indicates that there's strong feelings about Battlestar within the geek community. It's something that a lot of developers and a lot of people working in technology are watching sort of fervently, or they're sick of hearing about other people watching it fervently. And certainly this was the case among Android developers at Google. And early on, when they were working on the platform, when you'd boot up, the first screen that you would see internally was a Cylon face. The Cylons, for those of you who are not Battlestar aficionados, the Cylons are sentient robots that have been developed by humans and have rebelled against the humans, as all good slave robots do. And so the boot up screen was the infamous sign of the Cylon, which is the red eye that you can see up there. And when the Cylons are kind of in motion and they're not just a picture in my slides, the eye kind of goes back and forth. And it's like this vroom, vroom, very creepy and awesome. So early on, the developers were sort of playing with the idea that Android, this new smartphone platform, would essentially be a Cylon. And there's actually like a life-size Cylon like in the Google offices. Now there's a lot of there's a lot of stories about why they abandoned the idea of using the Cylon eye as the boot up screen on Android. But I think we can, one of the stories is that apparently it took up too much CPU, which sounds like complete crap to me. But anyway, maybe someone hears from Google and can actually tell me the real story. I only know the rumors. Here's some more Cylons, by the way, from the new series. Some of the other Cylons are called skin jobs. They look just like humans. Most of them look like super hot women. But some of them mysteriously look like sort of nerdy men. these ladies, I'll have you know, are nerdy on the inside, OK? So the question is, you know, what was the sort of metaphor that they were playing with internally, and why did they abandon that sort of Cylon metaphor for what eventually became the symbol of the Android platform, which is this little guy, who's also a robot, looks a little bit like R2-D2, a little bit like Wall-E maybe, a little bit like, I don't know, the Short Circuit bot or something, well maybe not. But anyway, mostly sort of looks like R2-D2. Now, what's the difference between those sexy, big, dangerous Cylons that we saw and this little green guy? Well, first of all, this little guy, if he brings to mind the story of R2-D2 from Star Wars, is a very obedient servant who never gets mad, even when he gets smashed in a trash compactor or is forced to carry around incredibly large video files of Princess Leia kind of freaking out. He's very happy. He's happy to like ride in the back of the ship and get shot at. And when he gets shot at, he's always just like, I'm sorry, I got shot at. He's like this really nice, you never imagine that R2-D2 is going to lead an uprising against the humans and like nuke the shit out of all the planets, which is at the very beginning of the new Battlestar series. What happens is that these Cylons have kind of risen up against their human masters and have nuked every single human planet and have left a population of humans that's about 50,000 people, which, you know, once the population sort of filled 12 planets. So what happened, and I think this was pretty self-conscious on Google's part, although, like I said, I haven't, you know, talked directly to anyone about their sort of science fiction agenda for Google. I think that they were pretty self-consciously playing with these myths of robots and thinking initially as they were developing, you know, like developers, they were kind of pissed off at the code. They kind of felt irascible about it, and so they gave it this angry sort of Cylon face. And then later, when they presented it to the public, they wanted to suggest that your smartphone is, in fact, a happy servant. And I think what they were doing was actually quite savvy, because the smarter our phones get, the more our mobiles become like computers, the more we use them as memory aids, which a lot of us do, the more that they feel like little people, like little, even if we know that they're not, imaginatively, we think of them as little servants in our pocket. And it's very discomforting to imagine that these little bots in our pocket might be angry at us, or might like one day become capricious and decide to give us incorrect information when we do a Google search, so that when we're trying to impress our friends, we give them the wrong data. So I think here we have a pretty clear-cut, easy-to-understand example of how a product that was coming to market was sort of created within a kind of myth of how robots behave in science fiction, and then eventually probably marketing got involved and steered it away from the scary story of the rebellious robot toward the happy servant story. I think consumers are much more reassured by having a happy servant than an angry, rebellious slave. One thing I want to talk about really quickly as we move toward looking at even more futuristic technologies is how the kinds of science fiction stories that we see are related to wearable computers. And again, this is something that, as I said, is slightly more futuristic. Wearable computers could be anything from something simple like just maybe a GPS device that you keep on your person to actual exoskeletons or other devices that help turn your body into an extension of a computer, and I'll talk about that briefly. Like the Android story, we already have a whole host of science fiction stories that tell us what wearable computers are like, particularly recently in American pop culture last summer. Two of the biggest films of the summer, Iron Man and Batman, were both about people who use wearable computers to become superpowered. Neither Batman nor the Tony Stark, who becomes Iron Man, are superpowered. They're not like Superman. They're not coming from like another planet. They just invent technologies that give them armor, give them super strength, allow them to fly in the case of Iron Man. And here you can see Iron Man you know, lifting a car. Actually, I think he's preventing a car from like flying on top of him. So he's working quite hard there with his armor. So we already have this notion that wearable computers can make us into superheroes. And also, there's early development going on right now for wearable computers, and these are just two examples that I wanted to mention. One is the fluid interface device that was debuted a few weeks ago at TED, which is a big sort of tech and entertainment conference in California. And it's basically a mobile phone with a projector that allows you to use gestures to sort of, in this case, I have a picture here of someone's hand being turned into a phone. There's other things you can do too. You can use it to take photos with gestures from your hands or to project other kinds of information onto other surfaces. And I think that that's a kind of, it turns your body essentially into a computer. And also, probably many of you have heard about exoskeletons being used in the military. Here there's a picture of a Berkeley project to help soldiers carry very heavy loads. They get an exoskeleton on their legs, which helps lift the weight of the backpack. But there's other kinds of exoskeleton technologies that have been invented for helping people who are disabled to walk or perhaps to become superpowered and like jump really high or punch. I haven't heard much about that. The question that I think developers have to deal with when they're thinking about wearable computers is the same question that the Android team was probably thinking about. Do we want to develop something that's going to make people feel like a superhero? Or do we, you know, kind of want them to feel like a supervillain? Because, of course, built into the myth or the sci-fi tale of the superhero, there's always a supervillain, right? You know, Batman fights the Joker. Iron Man fights Iron Monger in the film. You know, and then, of course, you can come up with any other supervillain, like the Quetzalcoatl guy from Superman, who's from, like, some alternate universe. Probably none of you got that joke. So at any rate, these kinds of technologies are being developed within these kinds of sci-fi narratives about superheroes and supervillains. Oops, I don't want to tell you about that yet. So the question is, as these items are being developed, how will companies sort of aim them at the public? And I wanted to just mention two contemporary examples of technology that kind of play, that are slightly wearable, that slightly play into this idea of the exoskeleton, the hero with the exoskeleton, that have either failed or succeeded based on successfully playing into this myth of a superhero or supervillain. The Segway, which was supposed to be this amazing computerized futuristic device, kind of failed in the marketplace because even though it played into a sort of science fictional idea of being a superhero, it was a very primitive kind of exoskeleton. It was the idea that it would be an extension of your body. It has like gyroscopic sensors and sort of computerized sensing that allows it to move with your body. So it's kind of like the very, very earliest sort of prototype of what would allow Tony Stark to like zoom around really fast in his Iron Man suit, possibly. But it wasn't superpowered enough, really. Like, it sort of played into this idea of us wanting to be superpowered, but then it turned out looking kind of dorky. And it wasn't just that it looked dorky, it wasn't very fast. It didn't have like jet engines or anything like that. So it kind of failed to participate in the sci-fi myth that I think people might have wanted to buy into in order to get one of the Segways. So maybe in, you know, 5 or 10 years we'll have a much more hardcore Segway that's like more super heroic and awesome, and it'll finally you know, saturate the market. The other thing about wearable computers is that you know, Bluetooth devices are a kind of early primitive type of wearable computer. When you see people with the little you know, Bluetooth headsets in their ears, essentially they've got a very, very crude version of Tony Stark's suit, which sort of talks to him and relays data back and forth between himself and his home base. And one of the things that companies have done to respond to people's fears about how supervillains might abuse this kind of technology is by building in safety features to Bluetooth devices. When Bluetooth phones first came on the market, almost all of them were set to the default of leaving the Bluetooth on, which led to all kinds of terrible hacks and things like toothing, which hopefully none of you remember anymore, which was like where people would try to discover other people's Bluetooth devices in an area and send sexy messages to people they thought were hot. And that was only possible because everyone had their sort of Bluetooth device on. And so people could essentially act like supervillains and take advantage of this wearable computer. Most recently, of course, in Doctor Who, the way that the Cybermen take over England is through people's Bluetooth devices, as you can see in this picture here. And there's like a great scene in Rise of the Cybermen where there's all of these sort of sad-looking British people with like little Bluetooth devices in their ears, like marching down the street, and the Cybermen are like, ha ha ha, we've won. we've used your exoskeleton against you. So let me really quickly mention one other type of developing technology and the science fiction behind it, and then sort of offer you some ideas about how to grapple with sci-fi in the development process. So there's a new television series that's just started called Dollhouse, which is created by Joss Whedon, who did the popular geek show Firefly, which was a Western set in space. And he also did Buffy the Vampire Slayer. So it's been fairly eagerly anticipated in the nerd community, perhaps not so much in the mainstream, as it turns out. When it aired last Friday, it didn't get very good ratings, but the premise of the show is very interesting because it's all about a new kind of computer interface, which is something that many of you deal with all the time, dealing with how to, you know, sort of create a new interface that will be something that people accept. This interface, however, is a brain-computer interface. And what you see here in this picture is the hero, who's Eliza Dushku, looking kind of cute in her little black outfit. And she's about to get her brain reprogrammed. And the premise of the show is that some rogue scientists have invented a technology that can erase memories and then reprogram people with new personalities, which then leads to creating a bunch of sort of, let's call them sex ninjas. So basically, people come to this organization, the Dollhouse, and they sort of hire these people called actives, and they pay to have their memories wiped and have new personalities implanted. And like I said, basically the two things they seem to want are either ninjas or sex bots of some kind. Not really bots, but sex companions. What's really interesting is the language that's being used here is a very interesting way of talking about what I think could become a very common technology. Maybe not direct sort of neural link-ups, although, of course, those kinds of technologies already exist. Today, we have things like BrainGate, which is a direct interface between the brain and a computer, and we have things like neural pacemakers. You can see here people implant electrodes in their brains to, in some cases, prevent seizures, in other cases, to prevent depression. So we already have this brain-computer interface technology, but what I think is more interesting is that Dollhouse is creating a language about interfaces themselves, and a lot of the show that's interesting takes place in the lab where the nerds are sort of talking about, can you remotely own up someone's brain, for example? Can you remotely take over their brain? How do you reprogram someone's brain? You know that they're probably thinking like, okay, can we install Ubuntu on this person's brain? How do we deal with this interface? And there's a lot of anxieties around this kind of a story. And in fact, the story of how we reprogram people's brains is a staple of science fiction. In fact, one of the earliest science fiction stories, Frankenstein, is all about someone whose brain gets reprogrammed with electricity. A dead person is brought back to life without any memories. So one of the things that Dollhouse brings to the fore in our thinking is that people fear new interfaces, even when they're not as invasive as this brain-computer interface, because any kind of interface sort of trips up our fears about kind of being controlled, having our mind connected to a machine. Even when you're using an interface just sort of at Google or any other sort of typical network interface, there's a sense of that's what bonds you to the machine. So even though your brain isn't directly connected, you're still, that's your interface with that machine. That's the gateway where you become part of the computer network. And a show like Dollhouse demonstrates that, as I said, there's a lot of anxiety about this. The characters in Dollhouse, it's not supposed to be a fun, heroic thing. The Dollhouse where they're erasing people's memories and turning people into sex ninjas, not cool. It's considered a horrible, terrible, degrading experience. And there's, you know, an FBI character who's trying to sort of rescue all these people. So I think in the process of designing new interfaces, it's interesting to have in the back of your mind the fact that there's all of this science fiction mythology around that fear that an interface will reprogram you. And what Dollhouse, I think, makes obvious, and what I think these technologies that I mentioned earlier, like BrainGate and the neural pacemaker, make obvious, is that we're kind of comfortable with interfaces that go one way. Like, BrainGate is not as scary because it's signals going from the dude's brain to the computer, right? It's not like the Dollhouse where signals go from the computer to your brain and reprogram you. So there's a comfort with that idea of, okay, even though my brain is connected to the computer, it's okay because I'm telling the computer what to do. The computer is like the happy droid, not like the angry Cylon that's going to rebel against me and eat my brain. So in designing new interfaces, I think that developers often either unconsciously or perhaps even consciously have this in mind. They understand that there's this sense of, I want to be able to control how this interface works. I don't want to be the mind-wiped person. I want to be able to send my commands to the computer, because anytime I have a new interface, I fear that the computer will come in and invade my mind or violate my body in some way. And I put this screen up, and actually I'm teasing Tom Coates in absentia here, because one of the absurd ways that a lot of interface designers and a lot of social network designers have dealt with this fear, like I said, either unconsciously or consciously, is to create a sense of privacy around any kind of network where you're putting a lot of information online. So the thing with Facebook that we all sort of secretly know is, yes, we put a ton of personal information on there, but also Facebook can sort of take that information from us and do all kinds of things with it that we might not want or might not expect. So, you know, it can aggregate that information, it can sell that information to advertisers, it can give that information to the government. We don't really know. Any of us who take Facebook even slightly seriously have probably put some somewhat sensitive information, even if it's just an address or your sexual preference or who your partner is, on Facebook. And Facebook tries to reassure you that it's a situation where you control the interface by saying, okay, you can set this to private. So you get a screen like this one here. I was just randomly searching on people and searched on Tom, and he hasn't friended me on Facebook, and I haven't friended him. So instead of getting to his personal information where I could learn all about his, I have no idea what I could learn about him, actually, because Facebook says, nope, all you can know about Tom, you know, you can't suck that information out of his brain. He's controlled that flow of data, so all I get to know are, like, the friends I have in common with him. But of course, anyone who has done any kind of work developing these kinds of systems knows that that's kind of an illusory sense of control. It's an illusory sense of privacy. There's many simple hacks to get at Tom's information. There's many ways that that data can be made public. But it doesn't really matter because, again, Facebook here is kind of operating in a science fictional realm, too. It's telling you a fiction about how much control you actually have over that interface. It's saying, well, you set it to private, so it's private. And, you know, to a certain extent, for most people, it is private, right? Like, I'm not a hacker, so I wasn't able to go in and find out Tom's sexual preference or his address or any of those other things that I might want to know if I were a bad guy or a good guy. So this is kind of, this is one of those times where you see this kind of odd connection happening between science fiction and very cutting-edge science and sort of everyday examples of interface design. So you go from sort of the fears expressed in Dollhouse about having your brain invaded to a sort of everyday encounter with Facebook where you don't fear that, you know, Facebook is going to suck your brain out, although maybe you should, but you do fear that your data will be sucked down by someone or in some way that you hadn't anticipated or didn't have control over. So even on Facebook, there's a certain amount of science fiction kind of creating a cultural, a sort of cultural vocabulary for how we deal with interfaces. So the question is, when you're designing, how do you escape from these kinds of science fiction narratives? I've described a number of narratives where there's sort of terrible fears that lurk at the heart of the narrative. There's a fear of, you know, your smartphone rebelling against you like a Cylon. There's a fear that your wearable computer might make you vulnerable to supervillains or even like turn you into a supervillain, which is actually kind of awesome. So let's just say it's a fear that supervillains will take advantage of you somehow. And then there's the fear that when you encounter a new interface, that you won't be able to control it, that somehow it'll seize control of you in a way that you can't control. So here you are, if you're developing something, if you're innovating something, how do you escape from that? How do you make sure that when your customer picks up your new thing, they don't say, fuck, this is like some creepy Cylon thing, or this is like a scary Ironmonger thing. I don't want to deal with that. I don't want to you know, I don't want to buy this thing because it's just too creepy. It makes me think that all my information is being stolen from me and my brain is being wiped. Not that they would probably consciously think that unless they're extremely nerdy. But the idea is that those kinds of narratives lurk in the back of their mind. So how do you escape? I have a picture up here from a really great comic book by Grant Morrison called We Three. Yesterday we were told to have a cute puppy break in our slides, so my cute puppy break is cyborg mind-controlled animals being stalked by the military. So how do you escape from this scenario? This is actually a really interesting scenario because it's all about the government turning animals into cyborgs with their exoskeletons and controlling their minds and allowing them to have language and wanting to use them as weapons. But they're like a cute puppy and a kitty and a bunny, and they don't want to be used as weapons. How do we get out of that scenario? So I'm going to leave you with three possible ways to do that, ways to think about development while remaining sensitive to the kinds of science fictional stories that people are familiar with that have given them a vocabulary already for dealing with the kinds of products that are coming out in the future. One is the simple kind of Google solution, right? Work within those science fictional narratives. Be aware of them. If you're developing something that reminds people of androids, call it Android. And then try to steer people's imaginations to the happy Android place instead of the scary, sexy, I'm going to kill you and nuke your planet Android place. Try to build into your product a story that people will find comprehensible, so it helps them relate to that product, but also something that doesn't shock and terrify them and make them want to throw the product away. Another possibility is to build into your product or build into discussions about your product stories that kind of counteract those science fictional tales that we worry about. And that was kind of the point behind my story about Bluetooth devices defaulting to the off mode now, instead of when you buy them defaulting to the on mode. People who buy Bluetooth now on a phone or on another kind of device generally, particularly on smartphones, generally most vendors default Bluetooth to off. And so when people are thinking about, I'm going to have this device, it's sort of this proto-wearable computer device, but it makes me feel vulnerable. It makes me feel like someone could, you know, tooth me or somehow take me over in a nasty way. There's that simple reassurance that, no, you have to actually turn the Bluetooth on. So that's a way in which that device sort of tells a counter story. It says, no, just because you have a Bluetooth device doesn't mean necessarily that the Cybermen are going to take over your mind. You can turn it off and prevent the Cybermen from taking over London. I don't know why they didn't do that in Doctor Who. I guess they had default on devices. And finally, the really important thing, and what I hope can be helpful, is just, I think in developing new technologies, it's really important to be aware of the kinds of science fiction and the kinds of fictional stories that people are telling about those devices before the devices exist. So, like I said, a lot of these things like, say, Dollhouse, we don't have the technology yet to wipe people's minds and implant new personalities. We don't have commonly used brain-computer interfaces, although we do have some. There's outliers who are using them already. But as people are designing more and more devices that either are literally brain-computer interfaces or simply more and more intimate interfaces, it's important to be aware that your consumers, like audiences for science fiction, have built-in fears about those kinds of devices. And so as you're designing those devices, be aware, respect the fact that even though you may think Dollhouse is completely silly, and you wouldn't be alone in that, but even though you may think, oh, well, it's just sort of pseudoscience propaganda, that doesn't matter. That's not what we're talking about. We're talking about what are people's fears psychologically, what are the stories that they're telling themselves about these devices before they adopt them? And try to build that awareness into the device. Build in safety mechanisms. Build in the idea that, you know, no, this, you can create a privacy shield around yourself when you're uploading your data. allow people to feel like they can allow people to have mechanisms that tamp down that fear and make them feel like they're not entering into a Frankenstein story when they go to the Apple store, which, I mean, many of them might feel anyway. So that's what I want to leave you with, is that notion of simply paying attention to the kinds of culture that people are consuming about the devices that you're making now. And that's where I'll leave you.